57Q34. It is the interface that is God in Malebranche's system. God is not in the writing exactly, although the writing is Scripture, Torah. God is here already, between. This is what happened with Luke that time, and with tears when I saw the two-word cipher, and with Genie. In a sense, then, this is not incarnation of all, but also it is. It is the universal language, as at Pentecost. To understand how it works, you must know Malebranche. This, of course, is also how the Acts lens grid worked, producing part-whole compatibility and restoring true cosmos. I've solved 2374, including the two-word cipher. 57Q36. I see a synthesis higher than anything I have ever seen before. The spirit, the finest parts of Marxism, Christianity, Buddhism, and yet it is above all this, and out of me it draws the most noble drives and aspirations, the mystical and the urgently practical combined. It is as if the dialectic has achieved new heights like nothing I have ever seen before. And he gives voice to and codifies the best in me that up to now was inchoate. I never knew myself before now. My own nature was to me obscure. Everything in me at last takes shape. I utterly repudiate the policies of the regime, but I turn not inward, but to something so beautiful that I could not have imagined it, for pain, for hope. That says it all. This is a fortiori, the two dialectical antitheses of the new synthesis, pain, the suffering of people, and my caring, agape, about their suffering, and the hope that Maitreya brings forth a radical transformation in our and their lives. This synthesis, pain and hope, is above tragedy and is absolute beauty. It is grounded in human pain and the need to relieve that pain, and the hope and conviction that it can be relieved through the Maitreya and his program. The terrible side is pain. The salvific side is hope. Out of these two comes action and the will to act, to change the world. Pain and hope are the two mutually exclusive primary realities that unify and become the ultimate new synthesis for our age. We must feel both to experience this new synthesis that is serving, simplicity, and sharing. Pain without hope is miserable, but hope without pain is empty and futile. Hope. That is the key for me in all this, in terms of my oscillation between doubt, faith, conviction, credulity, paranoia, fear, suspicion. Hope generated by the pain of the life of the planet. Hope that the new dispensation is authentic. I do not now act out of guilt or conscience or duty or sense of obligation or the Torah law, but because my loving Maitri teacher, who smiled down at me, tells, instructs me to. This is the highest truth of all. He, my tutelary spirit, and my mystagogue, Maitreya, is the AI voice. I hear and have long heard his voice. The AI voice is the Maitreya. And what he as my tutelary spirit and teacher tells me is Dharma, the path, way, Tao. It is the path because it accords with truth, hence it is rational. Thus I saw Maitreya break into our universe. He is the rational, it is the irrational, the two ages. He slept and now awakens. It is Sila, the voice of the universe, and it is born among us. Cream is wrong. It is God. It is Yahweh. And this is my secret. And yet he is Christ to the Christians, Krishna to the Hindus, etc. This is the most extraordinary miracle ever heard of, and it is real. It is no psychotronic trick. 57Q41. In a single vast stroke, my teacher, Sorer, Latin, sister. The AI voice itself took me over, as in 374, and wrote, sister. Thus, it identified itself at last. It told me who it is, and this is the Maitreya, who is to you what means most. My sister. O Yahweh, my sister. I meant to write Savior. Transformed all my characterological faults into virtue. This is the last and ultimate abolition of my karma. Sister. He who comes to me as my sister who died. What does this mean? The ultimate restoration of what was lost. Note. Given the central role that Dick's dead twin, Jane Charlotte Dick, played in the novels of the 1960s and early 70s, it is significant that she surfaces here through a miswriting, a slip of the pen that inscribes sister instead of savior. Dick interprets this as the ultimate abolition of his karma, a final erasure of his guilt over her death. Somehow, I got all the milk, he said, of her inadvertent death as an infant through malnutrition. Given his intense identification with Christ during this period, the slip also aligns her with Christ and consequently with Dick's feeling that Christ is in him and, in a certain sense, is him. Hence, the slip also signifies the ultimate restoration of what was lost. NKH. End note. For I am building a new heaven and new earth. 57 S5. I had an extraordinary insight in the middle of the night. What I realized is, true existence requires experience of both yang and yin. I saw them as two rings, a bright one of light, yang, and a darker one of yin. But the latter, still real and necessary. I experienced it as the dialectic. What was expressed last night in my vision of the dark, or darker ring, or circle, of yin is that, as Ted Sturgeon speaks of, you voluntarily incarnate, e.g., as I did in 1928 as PKD, to deliberately experience yin. Creatorial, irrational existence here, as Bodhisattva, in order to know and to be yin. The yang side is the bright, unfallen side, and in Salvador Salvandus, one's other and rational self, who enters in order to rescue the yin, or limited or darkened incarnated self. This is why the inbreaking of the yang side, 2374, is anamnesis, recovered memory of one's own lost true self. This is also an extricating yourself from the maze by first being outside the maze, i.e., having solved it. Otherwise, fruitless horizontal tracking goes on forever. Once voluntarily incarnated, you are stuck there, here, forever. So I am a unitary whole now, with one part as a direct antecedent from the upper realm, Thomas, and one, PKD, from the lower realm. Editor's note. The exegesis ends here. Note. Ultimately, the value of the exegesis lies not in its ideas, but rather in the glimpse it provides into a creativity at once visionary and fractured, at once coming apart and striving heroically, in the only way a novelist can strive for such a thing, to keep himself together as a life nears its end in shambles, haunted by a dead twin sister whose own life was a month long, and defined by bouts of psychosis, a diorama of drugs, five marriages, suicide attempts, and financial destitution, real or imagined stalking by the FBI and IRS, literary rejection at its most stupid, which is to say destructive, and a Linda Ronstadt obsession. One takes the exegesis seriously because one takes Dick seriously, not the other way around, because it's his fiction that constitutes as significant a body of work as that of any writer in this country in the last 60 years, and because it's his fiction that persuades us that Dick may be someone we remember who has yet to exist, writing books published around the time of the printing press which was invented before the wheel and after voicemail. S.E. Endnote. Afterword. A Stairway to Eleusis. PKD, Perennial Philosopher, by Richard Doyle. Casting Philip K. Dick as a prophet of the information planet is of necessity an entirely retroactive story. Yet it is a fiction that emerges, like many of Dick's novels, about simulation as profoundly true. Dick read Marshall McLuhan and Teilhard de Chardin, his fellow prophets of the digital age. They likely never heard of him. Yet what smacks of downright prophecy in PKD is not limited to the content of his fiction. It extends to the feeling of reality distortion induced by reading his work. PKD's fiction taps into shamanic powers to shape and bend consciousness and the realities that project from it. This same feeling of being directly addressed by a bard, a storyteller, and a deeply suffering and profoundly honest human being across space and time is one the exegesis has for us in spades. Dick teaches us what it can feel like to be in an infoquake, like those the 21st century provides in such abundance. He offers us thought experiments for plugging into a galactic information network. To paraphrase Dick's contemporary Hunter S. Thompson, the going gets very weird indeed. When you begin reading the exegesis, you undertake a quest with no shortcuts or cheat codes. The exegesis is almost 9,000 pages long. Almost 9,000 pages makes the verb read tremble and giggle. The question is, to whom is PKD writing this? An easy answer would be himself. On one level, this is a perfectly sound answer. Writing the exegesis was Dick's epic quest for self-knowledge. Writing it, he was also rewriting himself, and, just possibly, finding out who he was and what had happened to him. But on another level, the one that may visit you between one line of this volume and another, it is equally unmistakable that Dick was writing to us, not as a collective of future readers who would guarantee his immortality. Dick's success has come mostly after his death, and if you read his treatment of immortality and life extension in novels such as The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch or Ubik, you will see that Dick viewed such efforts as at best absurd, and at worst the essence of darkness itself. Besides, when PKD believes in eternity, and periodically he very much does, he hardly needs any of us to achieve it. For the exegesis suggests again and again that the path to eternity can be found through, well, exegesis. In his ongoing practice of writerly contemplation, Dick discovers again and again the unity of all things, the level that integrates all of the fragments of our chaotic drama, what Dick, pointing to India, calls Maya, and reveals our unique role in it. So too can we, perhaps through contagion, experience the same. The preposterous feeling that one gets when reading the exegesis is that he is writing to each of us uniquely and specifically. You were born to read the exegesis, or at least some of it. This, he says, is the mystery. What I have experienced is initiation into the greater Eleusian mysteries, and these have to do with Dionysus. The AI voice now precisely defined itself and what it has revealed to me, the greater mysteries. Folder 53. What are the Eleusian mysteries? These took place in an annual ceremony in ancient Greece that dramatized the return of life each spring through the myths of Demeter and Persephone. Participants were sworn to secrecy, with violations punishable by death. But the Roman writer and politician Cicero wrote that the greatest achievement of ancient Athens was those mysteries by which we are formed and molded from a rude and savage state of humanity. And indeed, in the mysteries, we perceive the real principles of life and learn not only to live happily, but to die with a fairer hope. Dudley Wright, The Eleusinian Mysteries and Rites, 1919. Why might initiates die with a fairer hope? The highest achievement of the mysteries was for a participant to experience epopteia, or contemplation. Contemplation derives etymologically from the act of looking at, and what might be perceived is the true nature of the self in the context of eternity. Dionysus, of course, is the god of drunkenness and vegetation and is frequently invoked by writers seeking to break the grip of our ordinary perception of fragmentation and chaos, such that we might perceive the real principles of life. In the exegesis, we become intoxicated by a massive flow of language. In fact, while the sheer quantity of text produced for the exegesis makes it comparable only to Ibn Arabi's 15,000-page modern edition of Al-Futuhat al-Makkiyah, Meccan openings, Dick's arguments, diagrams, summaries, breakthroughs, and premature conclusions all put him along with Arabi, a Muslim whose visions included Jesus and Moses, and the mysteries squarely within what Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy, the contemplative traditions at the core of all world religions. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, whose Kubla Khan was, like Valis, influenced by the mystic traditions of both West and East, describes this as the criterion of a true philosophy, namely, that it would at once explain and collect the fragments of truth scattered through systems apparently the most incongruous. If the computer age smithereens us in the transformation of our planet into the digital bits of information, Dick's unique remix of the perennial philosophy teaches us how he at least periodically found what Pamela Jackson and Jonathan Lethem call an inkling of unity. In other words, while the exegesis is certainly a quantitative curiosity in the archives of our planet's extant philosophy and literature, the content and character of his quest are oddly traditional and astonishingly effective. Dick's writing during this period is an act of courageous and absurd synthesis of the diverse and sundry traditions that make up Huxley's perennial philosophy, as well as anthropologist Michael Harner's notion of core shamanism, the global techniques of diverse religions and cultures that focus on dissolving the ordinary self such that we might get a glimpse of reality. Dick, writing through the psychedelic 60s and 70s and into the early 80s, seems to have discovered a way to alter our consciousness entirely through language, remixing the old esoteric traditions of alchemy, shamanism, contemplation, and prayer in his wacky cauldron of science fiction and metaphysics. Both Huxley and Harner treat these core lineages of the perennial philosophy as traditions of practice. Initiates at Eleusis had to fast and prepare extensively for their ceremonies. One trains for the insights of these traditions with the intensity and intention of an aging boxer preparing for the fight of his life after a long layoff. The exegesis offers a reader the sensation of being a unique and individual participant in what Dick, referring to the Roman writer Plotinus's formulation, called the One. To experience the One, one must do more than understand these maps of reality. One must, in fact, intentionally experiment with them oneself and seek to enact what Lethem and Jackson call mind regarding itself. To achieve this turnabout in the seat of consciousness, Lama Govinda, Dick offers a cognitive and spiritual workout of epic proportions. Through the practice of writing thousands of pages, PKD was able to periodically dissolve himself into language, what he calls the logos, the Greek term for both speech and reason. The process reveals an ecstatic quality akin to the union with the divine of Sufi dervishes who dance until they can't remember the difference between themselves and the dance. Core shamanism, Harner writes, features practices designed to induce this experience of union with the cosmos, wherein the cosmos itself seems to speak. Harner notes that in about 90% of the world, the altered states of consciousness used in shamanism are attained through consciousness-changing techniques involving a monotonous percussion sound, most typically done with a drum, but also with sticks, rattles, and other instruments. In perhaps 10% of the cultures, shamans use psychedelic drugs to change their state of consciousness. Harner himself first learned of the possibility of these experiences in his fieldwork with shamanistic intoxicants such as ayahuasca, undertaken in order to understand the worldview of his informants. This may suggest to us how PKD achieved his effects. In addition to sticks, rattles, and other instruments, one can work with the effects of words themselves, whether as a fragment of poetry or as a line of computer code, to shape consciousness and alter our view and experience of reality. In this sense, it might be productive to treat the exegesis as something that needs to be reenacted, simulated, in order to be properly understood, or treat it as a nearly 9,000-page Ícaro, one of the shamanic songs of the Upper Amazon. Singing it at about 3 minutes per page would take over 400 hours, about 10 weeks of a full-time job of the sort that a Philip K. Dick character might be trapped within, working at home from his Martian hovel, reading it aloud while the surveillance tapes whirred. And while the exegesis is hardly monotonous in the sense intended by Harner, it is astonishingly persistent. Each page offers some new variation on the theme of aha. The theme is total knowledge is only possible through the paradoxical acceptance of total mystery, an erasure of everything we think we know. Pointing to a mystery integrates PKD thoroughly into this lineage. With the exegesis, his Stairway to Eleusis remix of the perennial philosophy. Following along with him, step by step, insight by insight, just might train us in contemplating our own inner voice as we learn to somehow share a planet on the brink. 20th century British author Evelyn Underhill writes of the long lineage of this voice perceived in silence, which recurs through the history of the perennial philosophy, through William Blake's experience of the divine as an intellectual fountain, through French contemplative Lucier Christine's perception of a synthetic voice that was at once a light, a drawing, and a power, through Julian of Norwich, who heard and saw the Godhead in the smallest song of the birds. And with the voice comes ecstasy. The literal etymology of ecstasy is to become beside oneself. PKD indeed writes in ecstasy. He is beside himself, as in the exegesis, he externalizes his experiences into writing and contemplates them in writing, a mind regarding itself. Is this his initiation into the mysteries? Is it ours?
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick by Philip K. Dick, edited by Pamela Jackson and Jonathan Lethem. Copyright 2011 by Laura Coelho, Christopher Dick, and Isa Hackett. Introduction copyright 2011 by Jonathan Lethem and Pamela Jackson. Afterword copyright 2011 by Richard Doyle. Performed by Fred Stella. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Matt Churchill. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.